Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to come here and talk about Ron Muick and talk about such things as hyperreal spirituality, all those sort of things that usually only my students have to suffer in my classes at Canterbury. And I acknowledge some of them are here tonight, so obviously I'm not doing too bad a job sometimes. What I want to talk about tonight is, as I say, God is in the details, the hyperreal spirituality of Ron Muick, and it's going to be a particular take that might not be what you expect, but stay with me. It's not going to be full of jargon, I can promise you that, but it might be not what you expect. God is in the details. So stated the modernist architect Mies van der Rohe, among a series of now famous gnomic utterances, including less is more. This latter statement is also one that could be applied to the Ron Muick exhibition. For not only are these sculptures scrupulous in their detail, they are in their unclothed state, confronting us with the less that is indeed more in the way so many respond. As an architect, as a modern architect, Mies was one of a group of thinkers who constructed the modern secular world that came to fruition in the mid-20th century. His style of grids, flat-topped buildings, glass curtain walls, and what was known as form follows function, symbolised what became known as the international style, a system of construction, of order and representation that should be able to be remade, relocated, reconstructed anywhere. At the heart of this was the claim of the secular, of this world. Or, as later expressed by the religious scholar Gabriel Vahanian, the world of the saeculum, the world of shared human experience. As Vahanian went on to state, in a pluralistic world, it is not religion that we have in common, but it is the secular. For some 40-odd years, the Miesian influence reigned supreme. America was the new world order, and the displaced European ethos of Mies became the new American dream of modernity that could be translated and implemented anywhere, any place, any time. The grid, the cube, the White House, the glass and steel tower, the horizontal over the pitched roof, all of this was the imposition of a new universal order that looked to the human spirit, not the divine, as the location of truth. As the architect Ruhm Kuhlhaus stated of the new Miesian orthodoxy, Mies does not design individual buildings, but a formless condition that can manifest itself as a building anywhere and be recombined in an infinite number of configurations. So what we have here is the Seagram Tower in New York, which in a sense is the great secular cathedral, flat-topped, glass reflecting its creators, or here the Miesian grid office space, able to be reconfigured. Mies became the expression of the new grand architect, the man who through Bauernkunst was reordering the world out of the chaos of the absence of God. As the art critic Robert Hughes notes, and that's Mies, not Robert Hughes, Mies seemed to be the epitome of reason, straight lines, rational thought, and extreme refinement of proportion and detailing. If an architect copied him, he would not be copying a style, but emulating revealed truth. I also want to throw in another comment of Mies's, because at the centre of Mies's vision of Bauernkunst, the art of building, the builder's art, the art of construction. For Mies saw himself as first and foremost a builder, not an artist or an artisan. Therefore, at the centre of his vision lay simplicity, order, and discipline. And this is what Mies said in about 1922. The entire striving of our epoch is directed toward the secular. The efforts of the mystics will remain episodes. Although our understanding has become more profound, We will not build cathedrals. We do not value the great gesture, but rationality and reality. Baukunst is the will of an epoch translated into space, living, changing, new. Not yesterday, not tomorrow. Only today can be given form. Only this kind of building is creative. Create form out of the nature of the tasks with the methods of our times. This is our task. Ron Mueck's presentations, I wish to argue, can be viewed as a late modern expression of Baukunst, something constructed that are secular, not cathedrals. The constructions, for that is what they are rather than sculptures, are an attempt to create form out of the nature of the tasks with the methods of the time. In this, they attempt to express a spirituality of late modernity, a spirituality of what could be called bare life. This is a very secular, this world constructed spirituality. Yet, in what I acknowledge will be a very confrontational statement and approach, I believe they fail. And that is actually the secret of their great success. But this is also what makes them kitsch. And perhaps much spirituality is actually, in fact, kitsch. Let me explain. The term kitsch arose in Munich in the 1860s and the 1870s as a descriptive term for cheap stuff, which was seen as a primarily bourgeois and middle-class taste. Of course, now it's more generally defined as artistic rubbish, but I don't want to go that far. But I do think there is a strong element of kitsch in not only what Mueck presents, but also, and perhaps even more importantly, in how so many people respond to his constructions. Now, I must add a qualifier here. When I was asked to contribute to this series, I, like almost everybody else, had actually not seen any Mueck constructions in the flesh. I went on the images. The images I could find on the web. The images that were sent to me. And also I went on what others had written. Of course, this is what could be termed a hyper-real response. For I suspect that the images and the text are indeed more real than the reality they seek to present. So in viewing the images, reading the writings, and thinking upon what appeared to be occurring, I was able to situate the Mueck constructions and experience within a wider discussion of hyper-real spirituality. But then, of course, I made the fatal flaw. I made the fatal flaw of actually coming to see the exhibition. And believe me when I say that I was coming to view so as to write what I had already planned. Terrible mistake for an academic ever to do that. But of course, I was tripped up by the experience of the real, by the experience of what I saw and viewed, and perhaps almost most importantly, what I listened to. What was everyone around me saying as I walked through the exhibition? I can admire the technical skill of the construction. But what I was confronted with was for me, and this is me speaking, I'm not saying everyone has to buy into it, but for me, this is my response. It was actually an expression of kitsch. And the crowds who flocked, the crowds who were so enjoying it were, in their incessant photographing, their continued prurient obsession with the constructed naked body, and especially its genitalia. I don't know how many times I heard people say, look at that, look at that. Sounded like my one-year-old. Look at that, look at that. All the time. All of this was confirmation that what I saw was not actually art, but perhaps kitsch. So what do I mean by claiming that such acclaimed work is kitsch? and I understand I am perhaps a lone voice. Gillo Dorfler states the essence of kitsch is the confusion of the ethical category with the aesthetic category. A beautiful work, not a good one, is the aim. The important thing is an effect of beauty. Kitsch therefore uses, Dorfler says, prefabricated expressions which harden into cliches. This exhibition is, I argue, the expression of such confusion, not only by the constructor, but also perhaps most crucially by the audience. Of course, we could go further back and note it was Charles Saatchi who gave Muick his first big break, and indeed his crucial endorsement. And much of what Saatchi collects and endorses does, I would argue, border, if not often indeed collapses over into kitsch. For as Clement Greenberg noted in 1939, kitsch is vicarious experience and fake sensations. And this is Jeff Koons' famous, infamous Michael Jackson and Bubbles from 1988, which is, in a sense, the most sort of, that confusion of art and kitsch, the, probably the best expression that I could actually find. It was Greenberg's statement. Kitsch is vicarious experience and fake sensations. This kept coming back to me during my viewing. For right from the start, as we enter the exhibition, we are confronted with dead dad. A naked male figure, but not lifelike. For this is something neither dead nor dad-sized. So what did I think? What did I encounter as I walked carefully, thoughtfully, slowly, notebook in hand through the exhibition? To begin with death, with dead dad, is to seek to confront us with our own limited existence, with our own end, with the central issue of finitude. But this is not death or a dad, but rather the construction of a non-life-size body without life. What would have been the impact, the response, if dead dad was indeed life-size? My size. Or conversely, if instead of an adult reduced to a child, we had instead dead child, would we have gazed in the same way? Would so many have taken photographs of a life-sized dead body, whether it was adult or child? So this was not in the end finitude, but rather the trace of finitude, the spectre of what is actually denied, the reality of life-sized death. In short, it is death reduced to a gimmick. It makes the claim of death, the devastation of death, into just another exhibit of his technical skill. But these are not sculptures so much as puppets. And puppets that seek to make puppets out of us, the viewer, by seeking to control, to manipulate our responses. For to confront a naked dead body that is neither adult nor child is to offer, in fact to demand, that statement of kitsch, vicarious experience and faked sensations. Next, we come across the mask of the maker, an empty shell with nothing behind or within it. All surface, no substance, expanded to the point where it loses all humanity. Tellingly, next to this, we can touch the false skin. Yet to do so as isolated false flesh stuck into the wall, that confirms to our touch that what we see is indeed not real. What we have is instead a techne, a creation, but a creation that is a plastic imitation of the real, a reduction of humanity to a series of technical accomplishments. And in all of this, I do admire his technical skill. But I'm wondering what is actually happening. Around the corner to the pregnant woman, and here is the expression of life in the swollen belly. And this is where life is. This is where life starts. Here is the expression of life in the swollen belly, in the body stripped bare. We usually only see such intimacy in the ones we know and love. Listening to those around me, it is the details that everyone responds to. The details of wonder that Muick can make these figures appear so hyper-real. And if I could hear, you get a dollar for every time someone commented on toenails or varicose veins. And this is in part the saeculum, the experience, that world of shared experience, the shared experience of concentrating on the details, looking in the details for meanings and possibilities to understand these constructions. For the reality is, if these were indeed real people, we would not feel able to gaze and comment as we do. Therefore, the hyperreality enables us to observe, to focus, to photograph, for we know that these are, in the end, only very skillful constructions, very skillful creations, but they are not us. They are not human. She's eight feet tall. What we have in Muick are, in effect, lifeless robots. Technology remade in the image of humanity. A replicant that is a late modern, secular, profane version of the golem, which is Hebrew for shapeless mass. The golem, arising out of Jewish culture, is a monster in human form, created out of clay. They stay inert until they are given life when the master inserts one of the mystic names of God under its tongue. So activated, the golem obeys its creator, who can destroy the golem by removing the divine name. And the golem is actually one of the predecessors of Frankenstein, or Frankenstein's monster. Frankenstein's the creator. The golem is linked with the Jewish mystical text, the Book of Yetzirah, the Book of Creation, a book of numbers and letters. Most famously, the golem is linked with Rabbi Lo of Prague, 1520 to 1609, who is reputed to have created a golem to defend the Jews of Prague during a pogrom. And there's a story that the golem is still there in an upper room somewhere in Prague, just waiting to be activated. Now this is what this represents. So he's waiting to activate the golem to protect. Yet Ron Muick's constructions are in effect anti-golems, for there's no animating verse to be placed in their mouth. Rather, they exist as exhibits in a secular, profane potential of plastics, not clay. The choice of material is central here, for clay is, out of the book of Genesis, that from which humanity is itself created, out of clay, from the dust, and life is breathed into us by the breath of God. Or life activates the clay golem with the word of God in its mouth. these creations of Muick are entirely unnatural. Not from any natural material, but completely synthetic. Conversely, for the golem and us, there is the continual link of God, humanity, and golem through clay and breath and mouth. Muick's constructions are creations that lack any spark, any potential of life, being raw synthetics with no divine name or connection. Yet, as always, we can read potential links, even if they're not expected. For youth is full of links to the central element of doubt as to whether a body is real or not. The questioning finger of Thomas in the New Testament when he's confronted with the risen Christ. Is it really real? I will only know if I stick my finger. From the great painting by Caravaggio. What's happening here? Yet in youth, the bewilderment of the wound in the side is not so much that of the observer, but rather of the one so wounded. What I found interesting about this was the shadow that was cast by it. If you stand back and look, there's a shadow that hangs like this, which can be viewed as seemingly like a hanging, crucified figure. Could we reread this as a black Jesus? Are we being asked, like Thomas, to go up and put our finger in the wound, to see if the one so wounded is real? Yet, of course, having already touched the fake skin, the false skin previously, we know it is not. So here there is no faith to be tested, and we do not doubt that what we see is not real, for again the size of the piece reduces all humanity. Likewise, in a different way, the supersized newborn baby girl is turned by its size from what is the most overpowering sense of vulnerable wonder and awe into just another construction, wherein the details and not the being itself are focused upon. This is new life without life. The most vulnerable reduced to general observation, an intrusion, a profaning of turning the sacred experience of new life into something monstrous. Then there is man in a boat. Is this dead dad venturing across the Styx? But again, something about this reduces this from art, from myth, into yet another captured, represented cosmetic still. And again, the response of people is telling. And I don't know about when you went round, but when I went round, there was the incessant photographing by just about everybody of everything. Why take photos? Would we usually take photos of knife wounds, of other people's newborn naked babies, of naked men in boats? Some might. Muick turns us all into tourists and voyeurs of ourselves. And this politics, this attempt of biopolitics, of life politics, when we are confronted by the constructions of lifeless art, is, I would concede, his value. But only if it forces a self-reflexivity, not of what we see, but of how we see and how we respond. I sense, for what I heard again, however, here and on to the wild man, is that it is the details that are concentrated upon. Those parts of ourselves that we may choose not to closely examine. Toes and toenails, fingernails, errant hairs popping up all over the place, what our genitals may really look like. These are what people are responding to and photographing. The specific details are what makes each piece unique. In fact, we do not so much see the whole, but rather the details. For in all the pieces, onto the oversized, cinematic, screen-sized in bed, the eyes of what we observe do not meet the eyes of the observer. They look past us as if we are not here. For we intrude, we are not present, we are ignored. Yet if these were really human, if these were real people, we would not be allowed to look, to photograph, to comment the way we do. We would never usually see a naked woman carrying sticks, sticks that would hurt, that would mortify the flesh if so carried, her face turned so as not to have an eye put out. And if we did see such a person, usually it's in the context of madness. Is this exhibition actually a type of virtual tour of grotesques and the disturbed, such as was undertaken in the 18th century for the purient enjoyment of the observers, as Foucault reminds us, the tours of the prisons and the insane houses as a type of early sort of observational anthropology of enjoyment, the human zoo? These are the questions that should be asked on encountering Muick figures. Not the types of comments obsessed with toenails, genitals, as one viewer stated of the two women, needs Botox, to which all around agreed. That was their only comment. Is this actually the central insight? That we have become so used to the world of the artificial that it takes the artificial to challenge our notions of what could or may be real. Underlying these issues is the question of Walter Benjamin. Does the act of mechanical reproduction limit the authenticity of the original production? Walter Benjamin, German-Jewish critic and philosopher of culture, asked the question of authenticity in a world of mass commodification in his 1936 essay, The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction. His concern was with originality. He claimed that what gave the work of art its authenticity is the aura of its singularity. That is, it cannot be reproduced except as a fake. I mean, I could have Van Gogh's sunflowers on my wall, but it's not the original. It's a fake. As he said, the presence of the original is the prerequisite to the concept of authenticity. The aura is that which stimulates a sense of wonder and reverence, the meaning that the original contains by virtue of its singularity, its one-offedness. The copy is always a copy, a conscious fake that is not what was or is. I would argue that the hyperreality of Muick's constructions is what reminds us that these are indeed fakes. For the original is in fact those of us who view the constructions. As humans, we are the originals of Muick's constructions. And we are not synthetic, nor do we present ourselves so publicly to the wider gaze. So we get the inversion of the usual Benjamin question here. How does the presence of the original, that's us, that's you and me, in flesh and blood, how does the presence of the original respond to what is reproduced as fake? Now, there are those who will say that we respond with that wonder and reverence that Benjamin sought. But I'd argue the inverse. My response is engaged with the recent work of a great young American scholar, Mary Jane Rubenstein, who has written a book called Strange Wonder, The Closure of Metaphysics and the Opening of War. And I recently attended a packed-out panel discussion on this book in America, where the central question arose of, is there bad wonder? And if so, what might it be? I suggested bad wonder is kitsch, for it is that which lacks value. For aesthetics without ethics is kitsch. Aesthetics and ethics are closely related. For like wonder, they demand something of us that takes us out of the mundane. Kitsch lacks ethics and is the expression of the mundane that perpetuates fake value and meaning. Muick's constructions are, in their synthetic creation of unreflexive awe and wonder, the expression of bad wonder. Benjamin was concerned with the role of technology upon the work of art, specifically the impact of the photograph that enables a reproduction which separates the reproduced object from its location, its tradition, and its authenticity. For the photo's not a fake or a copy, but rather an image that is but is not that which it represents. With the photograph, uniqueness disappears. What you have is a multiplicity of images that exist without the aura. The nub of Benjamin's argument is as follows. One might generalize by saying the technique of reproduction detaches the reproduced object from the domain of tradition. By making many reproductions, it substitutes a plurality of copies for a unique existence. And in permitting the reproduction to meet the beholder or listener in his own particular situation, it reactivates the object reproduced. In other words, I can take a photo and bring it anywhere, and I take it as the original. So as Benjamin states, what is really jeopardized when the historical testimony is affected is the authority of the subject. So with Muick, what is the authority of the subject? What does it mean when we experience constructions that are taken to be us in detail? Is this why so many concentrate on the specific mundane details of these constructions? For they reduce our particular, our unique individual humanity to the level of the constructed synthetic replicant, whereupon the details become all we can really engage with because there is no deeper meaning to be gained. This is the hyperreal, the more than real in which that which is not real is taken to be more real than what it represents or symbolizes. Such literal representations become a series of surfaces that reflect whatever we wish them to. So Drift reminded a person I was standing next to of Jack Nicholson. Yet for me, the references were more to the young Dustin Hoffman in the pool at the start of The Graduate with The Sound of Silence playing, who's also told there's a great future in plastics. Conversely, in my head, knowing that Muick is Australian, and this looks like a bit of a crucifixion, I also labelled it the Lucky Country Crucifixion, in reference to Donald Horne's infamous 1964 book, The Lucky Country, which far from being a celebratory title, was instead ironic, referring to a lucky country run by second-rate people, a country whose religion is materialism. That's what Horne was actually saying in the book. Plastic art of materialist people in an age of hyperreal construction. This is what I fear Mueck's constructions represent. So why do they draw such crowds? Sheila Dorfler's noted back in 1933, all periods in which values decline are kitsch periods. The producer of kitsch should be judged as an ethically based being, a malefactor who profoundly desires evil. Ages which are hallmarked by a definite loss of values are in fact based on evil, and the fear of evil and any art which is intended to express such an age adequately must also be an expression of the evil at work in it. Well, 60 years later, Barbara Kirsten Black Gimblett, the B missing, sorry, in Destination Culture noted, kitsch requires the abdication of critical judgment because it tells us what to think and feel. To the extent that kitsch is understood as all effect, all surface, depthless, it is the aesthetics par excellence of postmodernism. So what does all this mean? How can we understand what is happening here with these constructions and the response of so many to them? Writing in 1935, Nicholas Berdiev in Freedom of Spirit stated, "The very idea of man can only be constituted by the idea of God. For man is precisely this idea, and he exists only ontologically through it. Man can not be simply and solely a human idea, or an idea of the natural world, for then he would lose all ontological basis and disappear." In other words, we would be a creature, we'd be an animal, but we wouldn't be man or human. Berdiev made his consideration of the Berdiev, in his consideration of the challenge of what he termed the machine age, back in the 1930s, made a very important observation of the ontological conflict between that which for ease of reference we will turn to man, between man and machine, as in the title of a famous essay by him in a book called The Bourgeois Mind and Other Essays, which I heartily recommend, and my students are probably all sick of it by now. But as Berdiev said, the machine demands that man assume its image, but man created to the image and likeness of God cannot become such an image, for to do so would be equivalent to his devastation. Well, 70 years later, Olivia Dienz noted that the over-defined body exists in a void between real and simulacra, between the individual and the multiple, between the original and the copy. This is from a book called Metal and Flesh, The Evolution of Man, Technology Takes Over. In this mode of thinking, we are still what Berdiev termed in 1935 the machine age man. Warning, but the machine age strives to replace the image and likeness of God by the image and likeness of the machine. And this does not mean the creation of a new man, but the destruction and disappearance of man, his substitution by another being with another non-human existence. In Mueck's constructions, we are experiencing the destruction of humanity, the hyperreal of plastic replicants. Yet because they lack life, we are reduced to commenting on the details, on how lifelike the details are. As my 12-year-old daughter noted as we walked away, after going upstairs to the empty galleries where no one was looking at Pat Hanley's Golden Age or Bill Colbert's Pacific Flotsam, Harriet said, "The Mueck's are not art, but rather the equivalent to dolls that don't challenge your mind." For upstairs, to stand in front of the Hanley. To walk around and meditate with and through Colbert is for me where a real secular spirituality occurs. "It's so quiet up here," said Harriet. "Why do you think that is?" I asked. "Because this is actually real art, and it challenges you. Downstairs doesn't actually express any feelings or meanings. They're fictional characters that should be in the movies." As the graduate prophetically stated in 1967, there's a future in plastics. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. I felt that bit. Breath of fresh air. Party line been knocked out. So great to actually have a different take on an exhibition in the gallery, and I know that there will be some interesting comments and thoughts about it, and that's precisely what we're wanting to do, is have some debate and discussion around these works, particularly when we think about contemporary art. Some people might make the same comments about Bill Colbert as Mike is making about Ron Miller. What are your thoughts? Any questions for Mike?
The key is because it's detail, it's larger than life. If you want to sketch a David, for instance, must be kept.
No, it's not the detail, it's how we respond to it. And it's what sits behind it. And it's the feeling of how we respond. You don't go and see David and just talk incessantly about the toenails of David. You might, but there's something more to David. This is not in the same level. There's something behind the David. There's a story, there's a feeling, there's an experience, there's a sense of real meaning and challenge. Sometimes our response to David can be kitsch. And what I'm interested in is how often our response to these is actually kitsch. And that says something about the time in which we live. We don't know how to respond to these things. And that's a part of it. It's such a popular exhibition in many ways, like a lot of them, because they are kitsch. A bit like Jeff Koons. Maybe Damien Hirst. There is an element of kitsch to that because it's easy for us to understand, to respond to. When I was here, downstairs was packed. I go upstairs, nobody was upstairs. Best time to visit the upstairs galleries in many ways is when you were. But I wondered why it was. Why were all these people who were going around saying, "Oh, I never come to the gallery, but I'm coming to see this," never actually venture upstairs to where the real art is? And that's what interested me.
You have a question?
Just you started off, you know, the title "God is in the Detail," and you know, detail occurs when two materials come together or two things come together, and that's the only reality I could get from the show, was confronted with these different scales of human existence as to what the detail, the junction of my feeling towards that. And I found the different scales sort of reinforced what was happening in the sculpted body.
That's good.
Yeah. I mean,
I'm pleased people had that response. I was going on my own response, but also what I was hearing. And I think that is part of it. There is, but everything I started reading about Merritt was always about the detail, the detail, the detail, the detail. And I was wondering, okay, what is about the detail? If I go and stand in front of Pat Hanley, I don't just look at the brush strokes. That's part of it.
That's catch.
My daughter put that on. Actually, that might be my ride, I'm sorry. But I've got ballet.
But
one more.
Questions.
Yeah, a couple more questions. Yeah.
Sorry to leap in, but I think you've missed the point, frankly.
That's okay.
What's Hanley work, certainly David, Donatello, what they produce foci of aspiration, they're epitomes, okay, they're avatars. When I go into the Murex space, it's not the individual work that actually is important, it is the fact that it is a space into which individuals have been slotted in the same way that we all fit into a multi-dimensional space with our own individual warts and balding and grey hair and so forth. So rather than being a collection of epitomes, what we have there is something we compare ourselves to, and that's why the chatter.
Now, well, yeah, I can see where you go. I think when I was last week, I was in Melbourne. I went to the Melbourne Museum, and they've got the body exhibition. Now, maybe this should have been at the museum, because it was very similar, actually, to walking around the body exhibition at Melbourne Museum. I think that might be the thing. I mean, I take it that everybody has different experiences to it, and that's good. I mean, I'm pleased that people have it. And the worst thing I can do is someone...
To what we see in there, in the same way as we reacted yesterday to those 29 photographs on the front page, the press, or the images of people... houses. They were specific houses that were damaged by the...
But see, I would actually say that the press reaction to the tragedy is actually bordering on kitsch.
Absolutely.
I think John Campbell down there emoting falsely and everybody. I mean, it's incredible kitsch. And this is the thing. We can only really respond to kitsch in our age because that's all we know how to respond to for most people. We live in such a kitsch age that is the kitsch that we respond to because that's, for most of us, I mean, most people who went and saw it aren't here tonight. Why? Because they've got better things to do, obviously. Understandably. But why do we want to think about this stuff? Because, well, it challenges us in some way, but there's a discomfort there. Now, Murex is kitsch. I will go to my grave saying it's kitsch. But what I think is even more kitsch is how we respond to it. And I think that's the thing.
Sorry, is it true that people have come out of their living rooms and have responded in a kitschy way in the company of strangers?
Yeah.
And doesn't that make you ashamed to have been part of that? It makes me ashamed to know that I'm part of a community that can expose itself.
That's the central claim I'm making. We live in such a kitsch age that dehumanises us. Mm-hmm. And what this really shows us is just how dehumanised we actually are.
Your thoughts on that? Yeah.
Seems rather cavalier to be critical of such a lively performance. Many things I could say, and I'll try and be summary. The first, maybe the simplest, which I don't want to dwell on, is that we haven't really heard anything about spirituality here, and I just appeal to the ordinary definitions and understandings of spirituality. And while secular spirituality might be a lively, provocative phrase of some time ago, perhaps now, it doesn't actually do the job, and so on for some of the other definitions there. So that would be my first point, nothing to do with spirituality. And then I'd like to come in on in the defence of ordinary people. This is clearly largely an audience of highly verbal, articulate, self-conscious people. And I think it's a little rude to be taking comments in exhibitions as a genuine representation of what people are actually thinking, or indeed might think if you ask them, what are the expressions here? What are these two ladies talking about? Clearly, I mean, I agree with you about superficial. I saw the pictures. I came along to...
I agree, but then was
impressed, but the impression was like a flash, and then you're looking at the detail and thinking, God, he's clever. However, I think if you were to ask ordinary people, you'd get a lot more interesting reactions, and it's too easy for... unfortunately, the overly sophisticated to be rather snide about some
That's
of those.
There's always a risk we take.
can I just add a little bit more, just in defence of dead dad, just to highlight an example of that. I went with a non-intellectual woman, and she was very moved by that.
My response is, having seen a dead dad.
And those who have seen a dead dad or a dead person, especially an older one, that there is a sense of shrinking. And so there's a lot more going on than just superficial imagery.
Having taken funerals, if the body had shrunk that much, I'd be rather... And that's what I think. If it was a dead child,
I could say that's what also I'd be more impressed. A lot of your critical...
Thank you, I'm going to stop you there because I'm running out of time. I do want to give a funeral.
I'm just wondering, if you say that he is the artist of Kitsch,
yep.
To what extent is he conscious of that?
I think I'd like to make an interesting comment on that, is that Ron Muick is overwhelmingly silent about his work. So I think, and this might be an interesting note to perhaps sum up on, is that we don't know. He might be in his studio having the last laugh.